This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Hello, how are you? I hope you're all safe and well. Sorry for the delayed podcast this week. We were desperate to do something as a reaction to the US election, but as you can probably tell from things that are going on, they're still far from clear. So we thought it'd be best that we hold off until we have a better idea as to who will win the US election. So hopefully we'll have something for you next week. But in the meantime, feel free to visit or revisit our election previews, one last week and one from back in July. Much of what was said in terms of how policies and the way Congress is split will affect economics and markets still stands. So instead, this week, we've got a special episode for you from the Value Perspective, which is part of the Schroders Podcast Network. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and it's about decision making in high pressure situations. This one's about the Ice Maidens, which was a British Army expedition in which six women from the United Kingdom became the first female team to ski across the Antarctic continent using muscle power alone. It's a fascinating listen, and I think you'll enjoy it. But we'll be back with regular programming next week, beginning on Monday with the US lens, and then all being equal, a reaction to the US election on Thursday. In the meantime, keep safe and go well.
Welcome to the Value Perspective podcast on decision making. We're a group of value investors working together on the global value team here at Schroders. As investors, we have to tackle decision making in uncertain environments every day. In this podcast series, we speak to people from other walks of life who also share the challenge of making decisions in complex and uncertain environments.
On today's episode, we have Dr. Nix Wetherill, a doctor in the British Army who led the Ice Maiden Expedition, the first female team to ski across the Antarctic, and colleague Sophie Montagne from Polar Performance, which provide corporate training and keynote speaking on high-performing teams in the context of the Ice Maiden Expedition. Thank you very much for being here. Can you talk a little bit about how you came about the idea of going through the Antarctic? When was this, like 2 years ago now?
So we left for Antarctica in November 2017. And we got back in February 2018, but it was a much longer process coming up with the whole idea and getting it off the ground. And actually, it was my idea. I had it about 10 years ago when I was at medical school. And it really came about from listening to somebody talking about their expedition across Antarctica. And I kind of got the impression that he was sort of saying, you guys are never going to be able to do this. And that's kind of what gave me the incentive to just prove him wrong. And that's where the idea came from. Why it was made all female team was really because I just noticed that in the military the women weren't taking up the opportunities that they could to push themselves physically and mentally. So it was really an opportunity to encourage them to get out there. And it was never about proving to men what women could do. It was really about proving to women what women could do. I think we reached out to quite a lot of people, Sophie obviously being one of them. And I think she's got something from it.
Yeah, it was amazing. I think for me, it was an opportunity to do something completely different. So as an army reservist, I was not full time like Nick's and came in from my desk job. So at the time I was working in corporate marketing in central London, came in to do my army reserve training and saw this poster on the wall. And it pretty much just said, we're looking for women to go to Antarctica. And I thought, I hate the cold, absolutely pathetic in the cold, but I want a challenge and I want to see how I can push myself and see what I'm capable of. And so this was really an opportunity at exactly the right time when I was bored of my job, looking for something different to do. And I had absolutely no idea that I'd make the final team.
So we're interested in choices, really, why people make choices, why people do what they do. And obviously one of the first choices is, you know, how do you put together an outstanding team of people to do something that's like this? How do you decide on the number of people, on the mental and physical characteristics they have to have and put them together? So where do you kind of, you know, ground zero, where do you start with something like that?
I mean, yeah, it was a huge task to just pick a team. like Sophie said, you know, we put a poster out to everybody, or to all women in the army. And initially we thought we'd probably only get about 50 people apply, but actually we ended up getting over 250 women apply. So it was, yeah, we then had to start looking at the final team and what logistically we would be able to take and what was going to be safe and what was going to be easy enough to manage on the ice. Initially we planned on taking a team of 6 women, and that was sort of an easy number that we thought to manage on the ice and keep safe. And then the company that we went with, Antarctic Logistics and Expeditions, they said to us that that if we were to take 6 people, we'd have to take another plane, because you could only fit 5 people's kit and 5 people in one plane. So we thought, okay, that's not a great number. It can make things quite difficult. So we then sort of started to build the team up. And we were... we realised that when we got down to a team of 6 of us, that actually we were such a strong team that by losing somebody, we were going to be making that team weaker. Yeah. So we tried to find every possible thing we could do to see if we could get 6. And actually they came back to us and said, oh yeah, we made a mistake. It's on a set weight for a man. So you can actually take 6 women and 6 women's kit on a plane. So that's how we came up with the team of 6. And like I say, it wasn't about just the final team. It was about trying to give as many women an opportunity to take part. So by increasing the size as much as safely possible, it meant that we could, you know, everybody could get something out of it. And in fact, we ended up breaking the record for being the largest team to cross Antarctica. So the
numbers kind of sound like they were driven by some pretty kind of, you know, sensible, objective kind of criteria around logistics and so on and so forth. But how do you kind of manage it when it's risk decisions around things that aren't quite so objective? So personalities, how people are going to blend and work together.
Yeah. So that was probably the hardest part of the whole planning of the expedition, was picking the team. Because like I said, we had over 250 women apply, and I have no doubt that all of them could physically pass across Antarctica. But it was about picking the right team. And I know Sophie will have a lot to contribute on this side, but we built the team from a slightly different perspective. So we weren't looking for people with specific skills, but we were looking to build it up together. Yeah. So it wasn't about trying to fill a place and a role and therefore finding the person that had those specific skills or experience, but instead just giving everybody the opportunity. And it was over 2 years. So we were very, very vague on what we were looking for, so that it meant that we could really get to know them. They didn't have a role model to or a mould to fit themselves into, yeah, to try and impress us.
So yeah, certainly for us as the team, you know, we had no idea what they were looking for, and we've very much been sort of invited to take part with the whole point was to have no experience, to have, you know, sort of average level of fitness, and we were going to learn all of that on the expedition. So actually going into it, you think, well, this is an amazing opportunity, but I'm not an explorer or an adventurer, and I hate the cold. What am I meant to be? What are they looking for? And obviously you're desperate to kind of have that opportunity to do something as life-changing as this. And it's a quite disorientating place to be, because there's no job description. There's no clear sort of set of skills that you're supposed to show. But obviously what we didn't necessarily realise at the time was that this was deliberately set up to make us be authentic, to be ourselves, not be sort of, you know, being nice around the expedition leader to suck up to her, and then absolutely evil in the tent at night. And certainly, I assume that kind of played in my favour, because I'm not very good at acting. But it was hard, I think, to be part of something where you don't know who you're meant to be.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
So when did you actually get down to the final 6? How was that process? Were people kind of coming along thinking, hoping it might happen? And then, you know, when did you boil it down to the group?
So it was, well, initially we took 50 to a selection weekend, and the 3 sort of key areas, vague areas that we were looking for were sort of commitment to the expedition, and Sophie seriously committed by, well, she'll tell you soon about her quitting her job and things. then, you know, people who just didn't give up. So people, they might not have been at the front of this sort of a running, you know, physical task, but they just didn't give up. And but most importantly, we were looking for people who just put themselves... Most importantly, we were looking for women who put the team as a whole first.
Yeah.
So they weren't out for personal gain. It was all down to the team. And that actually became really obvious quite quickly.
Interesting.
When people were doing it for personal gain.
Yeah.
We took 50 to that selection weekend. And then the whole point was, like I say, just trying to give women experience. And if they didn't make the final team, then at least they got something from the whole 2 years. So we did three training exercises in Norway, taught people to ski, and really put them in difficult situations. And that's when you sort of learn how people cope and how people work together and interact together. I mean, we were obviously very lucky because we were selecting from quite an already selected pool because they'd already passed basic training and everyone had already done some sort of physical mental resilience, which made it a lot easier. But slowly over that 2 years, we went down to 20 and then 12 and then down to 7. And that was when, we'd been training together for 2 years now, so it was really difficult.
7, one to go. That's got to be tough, right?
Well, at the time it was actually 2 to go. So at the time we thought it was going to be a team of 5. So actually on the final expedition, we did 3 weeks of dress rehearsal in Norway, out on the Norwegian Hardangervidda. And during that, unfortunately, the 7th member of our team, who is also our nutritionist, she's quite tiny, and she just said, I physically can't do this. So it made it easier in that she took herself out of the running.
Okay.
A hugely difficult decision for her to make, and a real loss to us as a team. But it did mean that then there were 6, and that's how we ended up, as Nick said, with the kind of ideal team of 6. And then the thought of cutting someone from what was already the perfect team was just kind of unfathomable.
So in a previous conversation that we had, I was explaining how the value team approaches building the team in terms of the team members, where we are obsessed with trying to remove all human biases from the decision making. That's the way that we approach investing, and that's the approach that we kind of approach the human element as well. You kind of opened your eyes, Nick, when I said that, and you said, "Well, but you're removing the human element, which is so important because that's exactly what makes up a team." So how do you balance and the other thing that you mentioned before as well was the fact that fitness was not a concern because many of the applicants came from the military or had a military background. Although I heard this crazy story about you, like training every day, coming to the city with like a very big tire to your waist and walking. Maybe we can talk about that in a second. So the fitness was not a concern, but the backgrounds and how do you assess the psychological side of it and the human element?
I think, I think I opened my eyes quite wide when you said that, because for us and for this expedition, it was almost 80-90% about the team and how it worked together. And you can bring everybody's skills and completely take away, you know, almost blank that human element that you say, so that it's completely, null. But ultimately for us, that was what made it, we needed that team cohesion, and having similar backgrounds or having, or even different backgrounds, but the fact that we all had similar ethos or priorities, and meant that we could all connect, and that meant that we were probably going to be a more successful team. When it came to sort of literally technical skills, like I say, we had 2 years, we all needed to be able to learn how to rescue someone from a crevasse. We couldn't just rely on one person and that was their job. So that's why I think it was 90% down to the teamwork rather than actually the skills that everybody brought. We had 2 years to train together and actually really begin to gel. And we ended up with people from all different backgrounds. So it actually kind of worked out that we probably did end up taking out some of that human element, but we all formed it together over that 2 years.
That's very interesting. And So as a leader, Nix, how do you prepare for the sort of decision making involved in this kind of trip? Is it just a matter of being physically and mentally prepared for the specific tasks that you are going to face, or is there anything else?
Big question. There's a lot of decisions that we're obviously going to probably face in Antarctica. I think, and this is probably down to sort of military training as well, you're always considering risk, and not just risk to life, but risk to mission or risk to financial, you know, people who have invested in us as well. And actually, my probably biggest learning point was that I wanted to learn from other people's failures. So I read about all the failed expeditions. I looked up why people had failed, why people had fallen down a crevasse, why they had to get collected early. And I wanted to learn from those failures and not make the same mistakes. So it's all very well learning, you know, reading about successful expeditions, but actually the ones you learn the most about are from those that have had something go wrong. So that was the sort of the biggest thing. And I think the easiest way I dealt with it was sort of breaking potential risks and decisions into sort of the known risks and the known knowns, as it is, known unknowns. So knowing that there's potentially going to be situations where you'd have to make decisions or balance those risk decisions, and then the unknown unknowns. And it was being able to sort of categorize each of those risks and decisions into each of those and then try and manage it. But yeah, it was a lot of pre-work before, I think.
That's very interesting for us. And actually, it resonates because we, as part of our process, we have this thing called an after-action review, where every single year we go back in time to the work that was done by other members of the team 5 years ago. And we select a number of companies and we try to go back in time and see how those decisions worked and what was the mental process behind that decision and what can be learned. How good were we at understanding the business back then and making a call on what we thought was a good decision. I think that you mentioned before is the session with your husband that also helped you to prepare for you as a leader, because he actually placed you in a position to think about things that you had never thought before. So maybe you can talk about that as well.
It was probably only about a month before we left, and I just sort of been speaking to him about some of the things I was slightly anxious about, and they were all the kind of predictable things, like being in the middle of nowhere, you know, thousands of miles from the nearest help, and only five other people and bad weather, and it was all the kind of predictable stuff. And he just suddenly threw in some scenarios. He's like, well, let's talk through some potential situations that you know, what would you do if somebody in the team said, well, actually this girl is struggling, we need to get her rescued, or they're not buying into the team goals. And I hadn't even considered that. I just thought all of us were on the same team, we're gonna be gelling. But actually it was somebody from an outside perspective who threw in these situations that just made me actually consider it. And actually it became quite relevant. There were a few situations which did arise on the ice, which, because I had just talked through them, all of the sort of theoretical and hypothetical situations, they suddenly became real, and I was actually able to not make those snap decisions or a sudden panic about having to decide what to do, because I hadn't even considered this as a potential situation. So.
We are a very process-driven team. We have said this before throughout this series with other different guests, that we strongly believe in the mantra of process over outcome. So in this adventure, how did you build a process that would help you make difficult decisions along the way and help you deal with the uncertainty of the unknown?
I think it was just, for me, it was just breaking it down into the sort of the known unknowns and actually just trying to preempt what might happen, and then just basically catastrophizing is the easiest way to describe it. Just if this happens and then this happens and then this happens, you know, what's the worst possible outcome? And so long as you've got that in your head and you can kind of think of a get out or a safety plan or whatever it is that you need, then it was okay. And obviously, we had time. We learned from our training in Norway. We learned how to make the decisions and when we might have time to make decisions and when we might not have time. And then the team also got used to that. I guess being a member of the team at the time in Norway.
Yeah, so we also, I think what was certainly unique from my experience of teamwork is we defined a list of rules before we left. We had a mission, and you would have thought the mission would be, oh, we want to be the first female team to ski across the continent. But actually, when we drilled down, it wasn't about just being a team. It was the whole team getting to the finish. So actually, that became our mission, was every single member of the team making it to the finish. And that really drove our decision making after that. Mm. So then we introduced a set of team rules, and we all brainstormed these about a month before we left. And within that, there was all sorts of things like if a tent blows away or gets damaged, don't blame that person, because that's just part of what happens.
Yeah, I think, that what Sophie said about the team rules was so important. But I think what was great is that actually the team rules didn't just come out from a discussion. They actually came out from genuine fears. So, for example, the one Sophie's just mentioned about the tent blowing away or being burnt down, it actually came from me asking one of the girls, what's your biggest fear? And she said, accidentally burning down a tent. And then everybody blaming me. We were like, okay, well, we can see that. But it then meant that we were like, okay, we understand where you're coming from. It's not just a generic team rule. It actually came from within. And so it meant that all those team rules had just that little bit more substance behind them than just sit down and what happens in Antarctica, stays in Antarctica.
It's interesting, this idea of making team rules suddenly makes me think a bit about the element of to what extent things are decided as a team and to what extent they're driven by whoever's a leader, or did you have specialization within key roles, that role responsibility aspect. How is all of that decided? And it'd be great to get both your perspectives from being either side of that.
I was the team leader. It was my idea. I came up with the whole plan. And actually, there was another member of the team who had a lot of experience in expeditions and we thought that she probably would be a better team leader. So she initially was going to take on that role. And actually, when there was 20 of us going to Norway, her style of leadership did work. It was really useful. But actually, as the team got smaller and our roles within it changed, it became quite clear that it wasn't really going to work. She was quite transactional, quite mission-driven.
Yeah.
And actually, for this to succeed, we thought, it needed a bit more of a transformational approach and a democratic approach. Everybody came with like huge amounts of experience, and it was just about being able to verbalise it all. And so actually we switched leaders.
But she still came along on the expedition.
She still came along, yeah. She was an extremely useful member of the team and contributed, hugely, but her role had changed.
Yeah.
And that was a decision that we all had some influence over.
Yeah.
But I think for me, when we first got to Antarctica, I remember sitting in the tent, and it was our first night, and I think we were all still quite excited, but also really anxious because we were just starting on this huge expedition journey. And I just said to everybody, because most of us were officers in the army, which hadn't been the intention, but that's how it had ended up. We all have an element of leadership. And it was basically learning to lead a leader, if that makes sense. And it was, I just said to everybody, there are going to be times when we can have a discussion about a decision that needs to be, if it's a slow time, and I will respect your decision, your input, if you have any. If you don't have any, then that's fine. But equally, there will be times when I have to make a snap decision, and I need to know that you are behind me in making that snap decision. And Sophie, I'm sure, will hopefully back me up on this one, but that meant that she understood when I was making these snap decisions.
I think it worked really well. And as I was actually the only member of the team that hadn't been to Sandhurst and trained as an officer. But then my civilian experience I have a lot more autonomy and management experience in my civilian side. So it was then, as Nick said, really difficult job to then be telling people, you do this because I've said so. And that just didn't wash. And I found that very difficult. Personally, I find that very difficult to buy into if it's not explained why I should. And so that was something we really worked on. And so Nick's was really good at this much more kind of transformational way of going about decisions. And we had a meeting every evening, which was the whole point of that, was to all bundle into one tent and talk about what we're doing the next day, share ideas, any safety concerns or any sort of team concerns. And then we could make decisions together. And I would say 90% of the time we came to a consensus. But we all knew that, and I think Nick's knew that we'd all agreed that if there wasn't a chance to sort of make a decision together, then her decision was final, and we all respected that.
Get in touch with us by email at shorterspodcasts@shorters.com or visit our website shorters.com/investor download.
Did you have individual roles within were there things that people were responsible for, or actually was it there are kind of the nature of the expedition is one where there are certain key judgments that need to be made at a high level, and underneath that everyone is, it's very broadly spread responsibilities. You have to look after yourself and the team, but everyone's doing similar roles.
Yeah, it was very much in the nicest possible way, like Antarctica is very boring, like nothing happens there. But obviously one of the biggest risks was crevasses and falling down crevasses. And one of the girls, she's got loads of experience in rock climbing, and she's a climbing instructor and rope work. And so it was her role, and she knew it was that if someone falls down a crevasse, she's going to lead the situation. She's going to lead the crevasse rescue, which meant that actually as a leader, I'd be able to manage
down the crevasse.
Exactly. And that was the contingency. We had to think of an alternative plan. If she fell down the crevasse, we all had to have some experience in managing that. And so we all did the crevasse rescue and all managed this crevasse retrieval. But we knew that if, she had one in five chances, we put her on the rope, the safest possible place on the rope. So luckily no one fell down a crevasse. But yeah, we've tried to protect her in every possible way so that if someone did, then she was able to manage it. But other than that, it was just the main roles were sort of pre-expedition, like logistics and things like that.
And just on the decision-making, I think what Nick's did that I haven't seen many other leaders do, and I think is brilliant in the civilian workplace as well, is that if there was a decision... So for example, she asked everybody towards the end of the expedition, do we have a rest day now or do we push on for another few days? And I remember Sandy and I said, we want to have a rest day, we think we should have it now. And the rest of the team said the opposite. And eventually they went with the decision to do the opposite. And before Nix had told everyone the plan, she came to our tent, to Sandy and I, and she said, I've made this decision. This is why. I completely understand where you're coming from, but hopefully you can see why we need to do this. And just the respect of, coming to explain that decision really helped us to then be like, of course, we understand it's not a problem, but it helped us to buy in. And I think that's maybe not done enough. There's not enough transparency in the decision-making process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that actually I wanted to pick up, because you kind of mentioned it before, and in a previous conversation you explained that it was very important for you as a leader to explain the kind of decisions that you were making. And I think that you picked up this from Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. So yeah, that's very, very interesting. We strongly believe in the impossibility of forecasting the future. And we have built a process that tries to avoid as much as possible trying to forecast what it's impossible to forecast. There's nothing more unpredictable than the weather. And many of these adventures have mishaps because of the weather, where actually people's lives are put at risk. And it's impossible to know what the weather is going to be 6 hours from now, much less what's going to happen over the course of the next 75 days. So how do you prepare yourself for facing that kind of uncertainty?
Weather over 75 days in possibly the most unpredictable continent on Earth was a challenge. But we none of us had been to Antarctica before, and like I said, we did loads of research to try and understand what kind of risks we were going to be facing, particularly with the weather. And obviously it's going to be cold and it's likely to be stormy. And so what we did was actually imagine the worst and then try to make it harder. So we kind of adopted the train hard, fight easy approach, which meant that when we went to Norway, we went at the worst possible time. We made it as miserable as possible, and mainly say that if we could cope with that, we knew, well, we'd hope that we'd be able to cope with Antarctica. And yeah, it was really difficult to predict the weather. There was one, like, it must have been on day two, and we'd already had been held up, so there was already a bit of tension, not tension in the team.
Pressure,
that's it. Pressure on the team for us to actually get moving and get crossing this continent. And we suddenly, on day two, got this... We started off in the morning, the wind started picking up and the visibility started getting less and less. And then I remember Sophie's Polk actually being picked up and dumped on the ground by the wind. And bearing in mind, these Polks weigh about 80 kilos. I just thought, okay, hold on, this wind is pretty strong now. And I remember everyone looking at me and just thinking, you know, they're looking at me to make a decision on what to do. And that's when the words of my grandfather came back to me, which were, making a decision will at least lead you somewhere, and not making a decision will lead you nowhere. And I had to decide whether to risk our life-saving equipment being shredded to pieces, so by putting up a tent and then potentially it just being shredded, or to carry on and hope the short-lived katabatic winds would pass through, which they're known to do. But yeah, so it was... It just was about actually just saying, if you're going to make a decision, you've got to make a decision, and just go with it. Because whatever happens, once you've made that decision, you're then going to be able to deal with the consequences. If you're just dithering, you can't deal with either side.
What did you decide?
So we went for the safety option and put up the tent. But actually, even that was then the decision itself is, do we all put up a tent or do we all put three tents? And then it was actually, well, no, we've got three, so let's put up one. Between all six of us, and if that gets shredded, then I'll reassess the situation and maybe we won't put another one up. But it was, you know, it was fine. And then, yeah, we were stuck there. Actually, it turned out to be the best decision because we then got in touch with the weather station and just said, can you give us an update on where we are at the moment? And they were like, yeah, batten down the hatches, it's going to get worse. And so, yeah, we were stuck there for 2 days in the end.
It's a really interesting example, that one, because, you know, I think sometimes when people think about risk, they think about it as that's a good risk or a bad risk or a risk I want to take or a risk I don't. But we all know risk is a continuum, you know, and risk is constantly being traded off against reward. You know, there's something the other side of that. So you gave a good example there of something where the risks are increasing because the wind is increasing, but the rewards on the other side, you know, depending on, you're already behind schedule, you need to meet this, you've got a certain amount of food, all this kind of stuff. So how do you think about that continuum? What is it that makes you flip from going, this is now a good risk, the probabilities of taking this risk are good given the rewards of doing it, versus we've now, you know, what in your mind flips and says, we now shouldn't be doing this? So it's a very unfair question.
I think that kind of going back to that catastrophizing, so it's actually, like you say, it's a continuum. It's actually a whole load of different decisions, and it can branch out, and it's being able to, I guess, kind of potentially say, well, if I take this step, where, you know, what are my decisions after that? And then the next step, and what are my decisions after that? And in this situation, it was risk to life was, you know, and that's an easy decision to make, is that you're going to take the safest option.
Yeah.
When it's risk to mission or anything else, then you're going to, you know, it's much more difficult to make that decision. But I would, just catastrophizing. And I think even then, if you end up in the worst possible situation, at least you know that was what you'd predicted where you're going to be, and you can then do something about it. It's when you're stuck in the middle that means you can't do anything about it.
Sounds like mentally being able to deal with it's a huge thing. And Sophie, I was thinking about Nyx and all her training and her background and thinking about, you know, how prepared she sounds to answer all these questions in terms of just mentally everything she's doing day to day allows her to think about that. For you, you know, perhaps having less of these leadership choices, but having maybe more of a mental burden because you don't necessarily have that understanding of what you're capable, or didn't have that understanding of what you were capable of, and now you do, and how you mentally kind of dealt with that through that journey. Because there, you know, there must be some epic highs and some perilous lows mentally on that kind of journey. So,
yeah, and I think I felt a bit like the person with the least military experience on the team. I felt like I had a massively steep learning curve to get onto the same page as them in terms of the training that they have as a team and about the focus of a team and the leadership training and just the way that they all operate, because everybody's trained the same in the army. And if you do that full time every day, it really becomes ingrained, whereas I do it one weekend a month and for 2 weeks a year. So I really had to step that up. And that was a great learning point for me on, you know, what a really functioning team is compared to my sort of civilian examples. But it did mean that, you know, from there on, it became sort of easier then to try and fit in.
Can you tell us the story about how you prepare physically for the expedition? Because I think that one is quite interesting.
About mentally, how you kind of dealt with that journey, the highs and the lows, and getting yourself in a headspace, not quite having the background of everyone else.
So there was another aspect, I think, partly to this was that I didn't believe that I was really the right person for the job. So all the way through the selection process, I was had all these imposter thoughts of, I'm not an explorer. I'm not really even a soldier. I hate the cold. And I really didn't know what I could bring to the team. And I think it was that kind of really ate away at me and was beginning to affect my performance and certainly my confidence. But actually being then selected for the team was amazing validation that said to me, well, actually, someone's seen something in me that I didn't recognise in myself. And that was been such a useful thing to take away from the expedition into sort of everything I've done in life. If you don't give yourself a chance to see what you can do, then you're never going to find it out
completely.
And then just on the just as part of the training, so as we went on through the sort of 2 year process, we all had individual training. We were all based in different places. I was the only one in London, and a lot of our training involved dragging a tire behind us, and the whole idea was to try and mimic a pulk or a sledge. And so I just used to do my commute at the time from southwest London to Farringdon, rush hour, and I'd be there with a Land Rover tyre dragging behind me on the pavements.
Were you like picking it up to cross the roads and stuff and kind of...
Yeah, I was completely the most sort of inconvenient person in, you know, probably the least popular person in London. And and all the puns about, oh, you must be really tired. and it was so funny, but, you know... For once, I didn't really care what people thought, because I knew that this had a much more exciting purpose than the daily grind of commuter life, and that this was going to be my way out of that.
Amazing. I wonder how many of those people that kind of stopped you or gave you some chat or said, you know, best of luck with it, you know, how many of those people now think, I wonder what I could do, you know, or have subsequently gone and done, you know, maybe they're not going across Antarctica, but they've signed up to a 10K or they've done something or they've thought about their own horizons.
Yeah.
But I think that's sort of one of our main points is actually that, we crossed Antarctica, but we, you know, and what we love to say to kids, because we give talks to kids and schools and things, is that actually we were all little girls sitting on the assembly room floor once upon a time as well. And if, you know, there's no reason that they can't do it. They just, you don't always see the sort of the glass stairway to this big expedition. Like, you don't see people dragging tyres through London very often, but you need to do those small steps in order to actually achieve something, like we did.
I'm certainly inspired. This is going to be very dangerous because my wife knows I have a habit of signing up to silly things once I've been inspired by things. So it's been amazing to hear this story.
We're coming to an end to the session, and we ask our guests if they can share with us a bad decision that they've made or seen other people make in the past. So if you can please relate to an example.
Well, so certainly I, with all the training that we had to do, I couldn't fit it into my annual leave allocation for the year. So I think it was in October, so that was a full year before the actual expedition set off, that I decided to quit my job. So then I found myself without an income. I had to move out of my flat, move with my parents at the age of 34, which just nobody wants to do. And certainly at the time, you know, the team wasn't announced until May. So it was still a good sort of 6 months before I even knew if I'd made the team. And I took this huge gamble, and all of my very sensible friends in the city who have, you know, mortgages and well-paid jobs thought I'd lost the plot completely, and everybody tried to talk me out of it. But
you were meeting Nick's commitment criteria there.
Yeah,
right up there.
Yeah, but it really was a case that everybody kept saying, what's your backup plan? What if you don't make the team? Mm. And genuinely, I couldn't contemplate it. I couldn't make a backup plan. I just thought, well, this has been my chance to change everything. So if it doesn't work out, I don't know what I'll do. But in many ways, a bad decision. But actually, if I hadn't made that decision, then it wouldn't have. I wouldn't have been able to commit in the way that I did. I wouldn't have had the opportunity to then change my life completely going forwards. And so probably a bad decision became the best decision I've ever made.
I think mine is, we were talking about this earlier, and I've definitely made lots of bad decisions. I think ultimately, though, not making a decision is probably the worst decision to make, because you just can't, you know, everyone says things like everything happens for a reason. And actually, no, you can make whatever decision you've made, you can make the best of it. And, you know, if I had to give an example, it would be I did Spanish A-level. I picked Spanish A-level, and everybody said, why are you doing that? Because it's not relevant to medicine. You're not even very good at it. but I really, really wanted, I just really enjoyed Spanish. And they were right. I failed my Spanish A-level. So it meant that I didn't get into medical school, and I had to resit it. But equally, you know, I've learned from that. I've learned that, you know, all the things that you don't just breeze through life or anything like that. You know, you have to make sacrifices and make commitments. So I've taken lessons away from failing my Spanish. So yes, it might have been a bad decision at the time, but it's turned out to be a really good decision. So yeah, I think not making a decision would be the worst decision.
You both seem like people who are driven towards endeavors in life that require hard choices, that are difficult, that are, you know, where it's going to be a challenge. It kind of seems like it naturally, even though you have quite different paths, naturally you both kind of are driven by that, which I think probably I'm working for a team where we're trying to make an entire living out of going against the consensus in the market is something that probably resonates quite a lot with us and maybe with some of the people listening. So it's been fascinating to speak to you.
And finally, we are avid readers in the Value team, and we ask always if you have any book recommendation that you can give us.
I've got one. It's not out yet. It's out on December the 26th. But it's Stand Up Straight, 10 Life Lessons from the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. And it certainly looks at sort of the leadership development and things that we will learn at Sandhurst. So I think it will be an interesting read. I hope it will be an interesting read.
Okay, thank you very much.
And my one is a book that actually I heard about while I was listening to a podcast in Antarctica. And because we didn't have anything else to think about, it really stuck in my memory. And it's a book called The Spy Who Loved. And it's about a female spy in World War II called Christine Granville. It's a true story. And she makes the most unbelievable decisions in the most horrendously pressured situations, rescuing her teammates from Nazi prison camps. And it's just the most inspiring story. And if there's one woman that can make a decision under pressure, it's definitely her.
Well, okay. Thank you very much.